The only place there seemed to be for him to lie down was in one of the cells below the city where they usually kept prisoners. They'd left the door open for him, so he didn't feel much like he was in jail, but the place couldn't by any stretch of the imagination be called pleasant. The air was close and thick. He'd taken off his shirt and lay atop of the covers in just his jeans, but he was still too hot. The walls were dull grey. Someone had carved the letters JG into the stone just above the bedstead, leaving him to wonder what that was about. And there was nothing else in the room but the bed, a cracked mirror that gave him back his own reflection in twisted pieces, and the sink. Not to mention the more than unpleasant memories the room stirred up. The brothers had been in and out of his mind all night, till he felt like a wrung-out rag. Since they were so secretive about everything, he had no idea if they were making any progress. They didn't seem pleased, but then, they never did. The real test, he knew, was sleeping. What would he dream? To sleep. Perchance to dream. He flipped over, burying his face in his arms. He didn't think he could stand even one more dream about hurting Clary. He thought he might actually lose his mind, and the idea frightened him. The prospect of dying had never frightened him much, but the thought of going insane was nearly the worst thing he could imagine. But going to sleep was the only way to know. He closed his eyes and willed himself to sleep. He slept, and he dreamed. He was back in the valley in Idris where he had fought Sebastian and nearly died. It was autumn in the valley, not high summer as it had been the last time he had been there. The leaves were exploding in gold and russet and orange and red. He was standing by the bank of the small river, a stream really, that cut the valley in half. In the distance, coming toward him, was someone. Someone he couldn't see very clearly yet, but the person's stride was direct and purposeful. He was so sure it was Sebastian that it was not until the figure had come close enough to see clearly that he realized it couldn't possibly be. Sebastian had been tall, taller than Jace, but this person was small, the face in the shadow, but a head or two shorter than Jace, and skinny, with the thin shoulders of childhood and bony wrists sticking out of the two short sleeves of his shirt. Max. The sight of his little brother hit Jace like a blow. He went down on his knees on the green grass. The fall didn't hurt. Everything had the padded edges of the dream that it was. Max looked as he always had. A knobby-kneed boy just on the verge of growing up and out of that little kid stage. Now he never would.
Max, Jace said. Max, I'm so sorry.
Jace?
Max stood where he was. A little wind had come up and lifted the brown hair off his face. His eyes behind their glasses were serious.
I'm not here because of me, he said. I'm not here to haunt you or make you feel guilty.
Of course he isn't, said a voice in Jace's head. Max has only ever loved you, looked up to you, thought you were wonderful.
The dreams you've been having, Max said, they're messages.
The dreams are a demon's influence, Max. The Silent Brothers said.
They're wrong, Max said quickly. There are only a few of them now, and their powers are weaker than they used to be. These dreams are meant to tell you something. You've been misunderstanding them. They're not telling you to hurt Clary. They're warning you that you already are.
Jace shook his head slowly. I don't understand.
The angel sent me to talk to you because I know you, Max said in his clear child's voice. I know how you are with people you love, and you never hurt them willingly. But you haven't destroyed all of Valentine's influence inside you yet. His voice still whispers to you, and you don't think you hear it, but you do. The dreams are telling you that until you kill that part of yourself, you can't be with Clary.
Then I'll kill it, Jace said. I'll do whatever I have to do, just tell me how.
Max smiled a clear, bright smile and held out something in his hand. A silver-handled dagger. Stephen Herondale's silver-handled dagger, the one from the box. Jace recognized it at once.
Take this, Max said, and turn it against yourself. The part of you that is here in the dream with me must die. What will rise up afterward will be cleansed.
Jace took the knife. Max smiled.
Good. There are many of us here on the other side who are worried about you. Your father's here.
Not Valentine.
Your real father. He told me to tell you to use this. It will cut away everything rotten in your soul.
Max smiled like an angel as Jace turned the knife toward himself, blade inward. Then at the last moment, Jace hesitated. It was too close to what Valentine had done to him, piercing him through the heart. He took the blade and cut a long incision into his right forearm, from elbow to wrist. There was no pain. He switched the knife to the right hand and did the same to his other arm. Blood exploded from the long cuts on his arms, brighter red than blood in real life, blood the color of rubies. It spilled down his skin and pattered onto the grass. He heard Max breathe out softly. The boy bent down and touched the fingers of his right hand to the blood. When he raised them, they were glittering scarlet. He took a step towards Jace, and then another. This close up, Jace could see Max's face clearly, his poreless child's skin, the translucence of his eyelids, his eyes. Jace didn't remember him having such dark eyes. Max put his hand to the skin of Jace's chest, just over his heart, and with the blood he began to trace a design there, a rune. Not one Jace had ever seen before, with overlapping corners and strange angles to its shape. Done. Max dropped his hand and stepped back, head cocked to the side, an artist examining his latest work. A sudden spear of agony went through Jace. It felt as if the skin on his chest were burning. Max stood watching him, smiling, flexing his bloody hand.
"Does it hurt you, Jace Lightwood?"
he said, and his voice was no longer Max's voice, but something else, high and husky and familiar. "Max," Jace whispered.
"As you have dealt pain, so shall you be dealt pain," said Max, whose face had begun to shimmer and change. "As you have caused grief, so shall you feel grief. You are mine now, Jace Lightwood. You are mine."
The agony was blinding. Jace crumpled forward, hands clawing at his chest, and he tumbled into darkness. Simon sat on the couch, his face in his hands. His mind was buzzing.
"This is my fault," he said. "I might as well have killed Maureen when I drank her blood. She's dead because of me."
Jordan sprawled in the armchair opposite him. He was wearing jeans and a green tee over a long-sleeved thermal shirt with holes in the cuffs. He had his thumbs stuck through them and was worrying at the material. The gold Praetor Lupus medal around his neck glinted.
"Come on," he said. "There's no way you could have known. She was fine when I put her in the cab. These guys must have grabbed her and killed her later."
Simon felt lightheaded.
"But I bit her. She's not going to come back, right? She's not going to be a vampire."
"No. Come on. You know this stuff as well as I do. You'd have to have given her some of your blood for her to become a vampire. If she drunk your blood and then died, yeah, we'd be out in the graveyard on stake watch, but she didn't. I mean, I assume you'd remember something like that."
Simon tasted sour blood in the back of his throat.
"They thought she was my girlfriend," he said. "They warned me they'd kill her if I didn't show up, and when I didn't come, they cut her throat. She must have waited there all day, wondering if I'd come, hoping I'd show up."
His stomach revolted, and he bent over, breathing hard, trying to keep from gagging.
"Yeah," Jordan said. "But the question is, who is they?"
He gave Simon a hard look.
"I think it might be time for you to call the Institute. I don't love the Shadow Hunters, but I've always heard their archives are incredibly thorough. Maybe they've got something on that address from the note."
Simon hesitated.
"Come on," Jordan said. "You do enough crap for them. Let them do something for you."
With a shrug, Simon went to get his phone. Heading back to the living room, he dialed Jace's number. Isabel picked up on the second ring.
"You again? I'm sorry," Simon said awkwardly.
Apparently, their little interlude in the sanctuary hadn't softened her toward him as much as he had hoped.
"I was looking for Jace, but I guess I can talk to you."
"Charming as always," said Isabel. "I thought Jace was with you."
"No,"
Simon felt a stirring of unease.
"Who told you that?"
"Clary," Isabel said.
"Maybe they're sneaking some time together or something."
She sounded unworried, which made sense. The last person who'd lie about Jace's whereabouts, if he was in any sort of trouble, was Clary.
"Anyway, Jace left his phone in his room. If you do see him, remind him he's supposed to be at the party at Ironworks tonight. If he doesn't show, Clary will kill him."
Simon had nearly forgotten that he was supposed to be at the party that night.
"Right," he said. "Look, Isabel, I've got a problem here."
"Spill. I love problems."
"I don't know if you're going to love this one,"
he said dubiously, and filled her in quickly on the situation. She gave a little gasp when he got to the part where he'd bitten Maureen, and he felt his throat tighten.
"Simon,"
she whispered.
I know, he said wretchedly. You think I'm not sorry? I'm beyond sorry.
If you killed her, you'd have broken the law. You'd be an outlaw. I'd have to kill you.
But I didn't, he said, his voice shaking a little. I didn't do this. Jordan swears that she was fine when he put her in the cab, and the newspaper says her throat was cut. I didn't do that. Someone did it to get to me. I just don't know why.
We're not done with this issue. Her voice was stunned. But first, go get the note they left, read it out to me. Simon did as asked. He was rewarded by a sharp intake of breath on Isabel's part. I thought that address sounded familiar, she said. That's where Clary told me to meet her yesterday. It's a church uptown, the headquarters of some sort of demon-worshipping cult.
What would a demon-worshipping cult want with me?
Simon said, and received a curious look from Jordan, who was only hearing half the conversation.
I don't know. You're a daylighter. You've got crazy powers. You're going to be a target for lunatics and black magicians. That's just how it is.
Isabel, Simon felt, could have sounded a bit more sympathetic.
Look, you're going to the Ironworks party, right? We can meet there and talk next steps. And I'll tell my mom about what's been going on with you. They're already investigating the Church of Talto, so they can add that to the info pile.
Yes,
Simon said. The last thing in the world he felt like was going to a party.
And bring Jordan with you, Isabel said. You can use a bodyguard.
I can't do that. Meyer's going to be there.
I'll talk to her, Isabel said.
She sounded a lot more confident than Simon would have felt in her place.
See you there.
She clicked off. Simon turned to Jordan, who was lying down across the futon, his head propped against one of the woven throw pillows.
How much of that did you hear?
Enough to gather that we're going to a party tonight, said Jordan. I heard about the Ironworks event. I'm not in the Garraway pack, so I wasn't invited.
I guess you're coming as my date now.
Simon shoved the phone back in his pocket.
I'm secure enough with my masculinity to accept that, said Jordan.
We better get you something nice to wear, though,
he called as Simon headed back into his room.
I want you to look pretty.
Years previously, when Long Island City had been a center of industry instead of a trendy neighborhood full of art galleries and coffee shops, the Ironworks was a textile factory. Now, it was an enormous brick shell whose inside had been transformed into a spare but beautiful space. The floor was made up of overlapping squares of brushed steel. Slender steel beams arced overhead, wrapped with ropes of tiny white lights. Ornate wrought iron staircases spiraled up to catwalks decorated with hanging plants. A massive cantilevered glass ceiling opened onto a view of the night sky. There was even a terrace outside, built out over the East River, with a spectacular view of the 59th Street Bridge, which loomed overhead, stretching from Queens to Manhattan, like a spear of tinseled ice. Luke's pack had outdone themselves, making the place look nice. There were artfully placed huge pewter vases holding long-stemmed ivory flowers, and tables covered in white linen arranged in a circle around a raised stage, on which a werewolf string quartet provided classical music. Clary couldn't help wishing Simon was there. She was pretty sure he'd think Werewolf String Quartet was a good name for a band. Clary wandered from table to table, arranging things that didn't need arranging, fiddling with flowers and straightening silverware that wasn't actually crooked. Only a few of the guests had arrived so far, and none of them were people she knew. Her mother and Luke stood near the door, greeting people and smiling. Luke looking uncomfortable in a suit, and Jocelyn radiant in a tailored blue dress. After the events of the past few days, it was good to see her mother looking happy. Though, Clary wondered how much of it was real and how much was for show. There was a certain tightness about Jocelyn's mouth that made Clary worry. Was she actually happy, or just smiling through the pain? Not that Clary didn't know how she felt. Whatever else was going on, she couldn't put Jace out of her mind. What were the Silent Brothers doing to him? Was he all right? Were they going to be able to fix what was wrong with him, to block out the demon influence? She had spent a sleepless night the evening before, staring into the darkness of her bedroom and worrying until she felt literally sick. More than anything else, she wished he was here. She had picked out the dress she was wearing tonight, pale gold and more fitted to her body than anything she usually wore, with the express hope that Jace would like it. Now he wasn't going to see her in it. That was a shallow thing to worry about, she knew. She'd go around dressed in a barrel for the rest of her life if it meant Jace would get better. Besides, he was always telling her she was beautiful, and he never complained about the fact that she mostly wore jeans and sneakers. But she had thought he would like this. Standing in front of her mirror tonight, she had almost felt beautiful. Her mother had always said that she herself had been a late bloomer, and Clary, looking at her own reflection, had wondered if the same thing might happen to her. She wasn't flat as a board anymore. She'd had to go up a bra size this past year. And if she squinted, she thought she could see... Yes, those were definitely hips. She had curves. Small ones, but you had to start somewhere. She kept her jewelry simple. Very simple. She put her hand up and touched the Morgenstern ring on its chain around her throat. She had put it on again, for the first time in days, that morning. She felt as if it were a silent gesture of confidence in Jace, a way of signaling her loyalty, whether he knew about it or not. She had decided she would wear it until she saw him again.
"Clarissa Morgenstern,"
said a soft voice at her shoulder. Clary turned in surprise. The voice wasn't familiar. Standing there was a slim, tall girl who looked about 20. Her skin was milk pale, threaded with veins the clear green of sap, and her blonde hair had the same greenish tint. Her eyes were solid blue, like marbles, and she wore a slip of a blue dress, so thin that Clary thought she had to be freezing. Memory swam up slowly from the depths. "Kaylee," Clary said slowly, recognizing the fairy waitress from Taki's who had served her in the Lightwoods more than once. A flicker reminded her that there had been some intimation that Kaylee and Jace had once had a fling, but the fact seemed so minor in the face of everything else that she couldn't bring herself to mind it. "I didn't realize... Do you know Luke?"
"Do not mistake me for a guest at this occasion," said Kaylee,
her thin hand tracing a casually indifferent gesture on the air.
"My lady sent me here to find you, not to attend the festivities."
She glanced curiously over her shoulder, her all-blue eyes shining.
"Though I had not realized that your mother was marrying a werewolf."
Clary raised her eyebrows. "And?" Kaylee looked her up and down with some amusement.
"My lady said you were quite flinty, despite your small size. In the court, you would be looked down on for having such short stature."
"We're not in the court," said Clary, "and we're not in Taki's, which means you came to me, which means you have 5 seconds to tell me what the Sealy Queen wants. I don't like her much, and I'm not in the mood for her games." Kaylee pointed a thin green-nailed finger at Clary's throat.
"My lady said to ask you," she said, "why you wear the Morgenstern ring. Is it to acknowledge your father?"
Clary's hand stole to her throat. "It's for Jace, because Jace gave it to me," she said before she could help herself, and then cursed herself quietly. It wasn't smart to tell the Sealy Queen more than you had to.
"But he is not a Morgenstern," said Kaylee, "but a Herondale, and they have their own ring, a pattern of herons rather than morning stars. And does that not suit him better, a soul that soars like a bird in flight rather than falling like Lucifer?"
"Kaylee," Clary ground out between her teeth, "what does the Sealy Queen want?" The fairy girl laughed.
"Why," she said, "only to give you this."
She held out something in her hand, a tiny silver bell pendant with a loop at the end of the handle so that it could be strung on a chain. As Kaylee moved her hand forward, the bell chimed, light and as sweet as rain. Clary shrank back. "I do not want the gifts of your lady," she said, "for they come freighted with lies and expectations. I will not owe the queen anything."
"It is not a gift," Kaylee said impatiently. "It is a means of summoning. The queen forgives you for your earlier stubbornness. She expects there is a time soon in which you will want her help. She is willing to offer it to you, should you choose to ask. Simply ring that bell, and a servant of the court will come and bring you to her."
Clary shook her head. "I will not ring it." Kaylee shrugged.
"Then it should cost you nothing to take it."
As if in a dream, Clary saw her own hand reach out, her fingers hover over the bell.
"You would do anything to save him," said Kaylee, her voice thin and as sweet as the bell's ring. "Whatever it costs you, whatever you might owe to hell or heaven, would you not?"
Remembered voices chimed in Clary's head.
"Did you ever stop to wonder what untruths might have been in the tale your mother told you that served her purpose in telling it? Do you truly think you know each and every secret of your past?"
Madame Dorothea told Jace he would fall in love with the wrong person.
"He is not beyond saving, but it will be difficult."
The bell clanged as Clary took it, folding it into her palm. Kaylee smiled, her blue eyes shining like glass beads.
"A wise choice."
Clary hesitated, but before she could thrust the bell back at the fairy girl, she heard someone call her name and turned to see her mother making her way through the crowd toward her. She turned back hastily, but was not surprised to see that Kaylee was gone, having melted away into the crowd, like mist burning away in the morning sun.
"Clary," Jocelyn said, reaching her, "I was looking for you, and then Luke pointed you out, just standing over here by yourself. Is everything okay?"
"Just standing over here by yourself." Clary wondered what kind of glamour Kaylee had been using. Her mother ought to be able to see through most. "I'm fine, Mom."
"Where's Simon? I thought he was coming."
Of course she would think of Simon first, Clary thought, not Jace. Even though Jace had been supposed to come, and, as Clary's boyfriend, he probably ought to even have been there early.
"Mom," she said, and then paused.
"Do you think you'll ever like Jace?" Jocelyn's green eyes softened. "I did notice he wasn't here, Clary. I just didn't know if you'd want to talk about it." "I mean," Clary went on doggedly, "do you think there's something he could do to make you like him?"
"Yes," Jocelyn said. "He could make you happy."
She touched Clary's face lightly, and Clary clenched her own hand, feeling the bell pressed into her skin.
"He does make me happy," Clary said. "But he can't control everything in the world, Mom. Other things happen."
She fumbled for words. How could she explain that it wasn't Jace making her unhappy, but what was happening to him, without revealing what that was?
"You love him so much," Jocelyn said gently.
"It scares me. I've always wanted to keep you protected." "And look how that worked out," Clary began, and then softened her voice. This wasn't the time to blame her mother or fight with her, not now. Not with Luke looking over at them from the doorway, his face alight with love and anxiety.
"If you just knew him," she said, a little hopelessly.
"But I guess everyone says that about their boyfriend."
"You're right," Jocelyn said, surprising her.
"I don't know him. Not really. I see him, and he reminds me a little of his mother somehow.
I don't know why. He doesn't look like her.
Except that she was also beautiful, and she had that terrible vulnerability that he has."
"Vulnerability?"
Clary was astonished. She had never thought anyone but herself thought of Jace as vulnerable. "Oh, yes," said Jocelyn. "I wanted to hate her for taking Stephen away from Amatis. But you just couldn't help wanting to protect Celine. Jace has a little of that." She sounded lost in thought. "Or maybe it's just that beautiful things are so easily broken by the world." She lowered her hand. "It doesn't matter. I have my memories to contend with, but they're my memories. Jace shouldn't bear the weight of them. I will tell you one thing, though. If he didn't love you like he does, and it's written all over his face whenever he looks at you, I wouldn't tolerate him for even a moment. So keep that in mind when you're being angry with me." She waved off Clary's protestation that she wasn't angry with a smile and a pat on the cheek, and headed back toward Luke with a last appeal for Clary to get out among the crowd and mingle. Clary nodded and said nothing, looking after her mother as she went and feeling the bell sear against the inside of her hand where she clutched it, like the tip of a burning match.
The area around the ironworks was mostly warehouses and art galleries, the kind of neighborhood that emptied out at night, so it didn't take too long for Jordan and Simon to find a parking space. Simon jumped down out of the truck, only to find Jordan already on the sidewalk, looking at him critically. Simon hadn't packed any nice clothes when he'd left his house. He didn't have anything on him fancier than a bomber jacket that once belonged to his dad, so he and Jordan spent the afternoon prowling the East Village for a decent outfit for him to wear. They finally found an old Xenia suit in a consignment shop called Love Saves the Day that mostly sold glitter platform boots and 60s Pucci scarves. Simon suspected it was where Magnus got most of his clothes.
"What?"
he said now, self-consciously pulling down the sleeves of his suit jacket. It was a little too small for him, though Jordan had opined that if he never buttoned it, no one would notice.
"How bad do I look?"
Jordan shrugged.
"You won't crack any mirrors," he said. "I was just wondering if you were armed. You want anything? A dagger, maybe?"
He opened his own suit jacket just a bit, and Simon saw something long and metallic glinting against the inside lining.
"No wonder you and Jace like each other so much. You're both crazy walking arsenals."
Simon shook his head in weariness and turned his head toward the ironwork entrance. It was across the street, a wide gold awning shadowing a rectangle of sidewalk that had been decorated with a dark red carpet with the gold image of a wolf stamped onto it. Simon couldn't help being slightly amused. Leaning against one of the poles, holding up the awning, was Isabel. She had her hair up and was wearing a long red dress, slid up the side to show most of her leg. Loops of gold laddered her right arm. They looked like bracelets, but Simon knew they were really her electrum whip. She was covered in marks. They twined her arms, threaded their way up her thigh, necklaced her throat, and decorated her chest, a great deal of which was visible, thanks to the plunging neckline of her dress. Simon tried not to stare.
"Hey, Isabel," he said.
Beside him, Jordan was also trying not to stare.
He said. "Hi, I'm Jordan."
"We met," Isabel said coldly, ignoring his proffered hand.
"Maya was trying to rip your face off, quite rightly, too."
Jordan looked worried.
"Is she here? Is she okay?"
"She's here," said Isabel.
"Not that how she feels is any of your business."
"I feel a sense of responsibility," said Jordan.
"And where is this feeling located? In your pants, perhaps?"
Jordan looked indignant. Isabel waved a slim, decorated hand.
"Look, whatever you did in the past, it's past. I know you're prey to lupus now, and I told Maya what that means. She's willing to accept that you're here and ignore you, but that's all you get. Don't bother her. Don't try to talk to her. Don't even look at her, or I'll fold you in half so many times you'll look like a tiny origami werewolf."
Simon snorted.
"Laugh away," Isabel pointed at him. "She doesn't want to talk to you either. So despite the fact she looks totally babelicious tonight, and if I were into chicks, I would completely go for her, neither of you are allowed to talk to her. Got it?"
They nodded, looking at their shoes like middle schoolers who'd just been handed detention slips. Isabel unpeeled herself from the pole.
"Great. Let's go on in."
Chapter 15. Beati Bellicosi. The inside of the ironworks was alive with ropes of shimmering multicolored lights. Quite a few guests were already sitting, but just as many were milling around, carrying champagne glasses full of pale, fizzing liquid. Waiters, who were also werewolves. Simon noted the whole event seemed to be staffed by members of Luke's pack. Moved among the guests, handing out champagne flutes. Simon declined one. Ever since his experience at Magnus's party, he hadn't felt safe drinking anything that he hadn't prepared himself, and besides, he never knew which non-blood liquids were going to stay down and which would make him sick. Maya was standing over by one of the brick pillars, talking to two other werewolves and laughing. She wore a brilliant orange satin sheath dress that set off her dark skin, and her hair was a wild halo of brown gold curls around her face. She caught sight of Simon and Jordan and deliberately turned away. The back of her dress was a low V that showed a lot of bare skin, including a tattoo of a butterfly across her lower spine.
I don't think she had that when I knew her, Jordan said. That tattoo, I mean.
Simon looked at Jordan. He was goggling at his ex-girlfriend with the sort of obvious longing that Simon suspected was going to get him punched in the face by Isabel if he wasn't careful.
Come on, he said, putting his hand against Jordan's back and shoving lightly. Let's go see where it was setting.
Isabel, who had been watching them over her shoulder, smiled a cat-like smile.
Good idea.
They made their way through the crowd to the area where the tables were, only to find that their table was already half occupied. Clary sat in one of the seats, looking down into a champagne glass full of what was most likely ginger ale. Next to her were Alec and Magnus, both in the dark suits they'd worn when they'd come from Vienna. Magnus seemed to be playing with the fringed edges of his long white scarf. Alec, his arms crossed over his chest, was staring ferociously into the distance. Clary, on seeing Simon and Jordan, bounced to her feet, relief evident on her face. She came around the table to greet Simon, and he saw that she was wearing a very plain gold silk dress and low gold sandals. Without heels to give her height, she looked tiny. The Morgenstern ring was around her neck, its silver glinting against the chain that held it. She reached up to hug him and muttered,
I think Alec and Magnus are fighting.
Looks like it, he muttered back. Where's your boyfriend?
At that, she detached her arms from his neck.
He got held up at the Institute. She turned. Hey, Kyle.
He smiled a little awkwardly.
It's Jordan, actually.
So I've heard. Clary gestured toward the table. Well, we might as well sit. I think pretty soon there's going to be toasting and stuff, and then hopefully food.
They all sat. There was a long, awkward silence.
So, Magnus said finally, running a long white finger around the rim of his champagne glass. Jordan, I hear you're in the Praetor Lupus. I see you're wearing one of their medallions. What does it say on it?
Jordan nodded. He was flushed, his hazel eyes sparkling, his attention clearly only partly on the conversation. He was following Myra around the room with his eyes, his fingers nervously clenching and unclenching on the edge of the tablecloth. Simon doubted he was even aware of it.
Beati Bellicosi. Blessed are the warriors.
Good organization, said Magnus. I knew the man who founded it back in the 1800s, Woolsey Scott. Respectable old werewolf family.
Alec made an ugly sound in the back of his throat.
Did you sleep with him too?
Magnus's cat eyes widened.
Alexander! Well, I don't know anything about your past, do I? Alec demanded. You won't tell me anything, you just say it doesn't matter.
Magnus's face was expressionless, but there was a dark tinge of anger to his voice.
Does this mean every time I mention anyone I've ever met, you're going to ask me if I had an affair with them?
Alec's expression was stubborn, but Simon couldn't help having a flash of sympathy. The hurt behind his blue eyes was clear.
Maybe.
I met Napoleon once, said Magnus. We didn't have an affair, though. He was shockingly prudish for a Frenchman.
You met Napoleon?
Jordan, who appeared to be missing most of the conversation, looked impressed.
So it's true what they say about warlocks, then?
Alec gave him a very unpleasant look.
What's true?
Alexander, said Magnus coldly, and Clary met Simon's eyes across the table. Hers were wide, green, and full of an expression that said, uh-oh.
You can't be rude to everyone who talks to me.
Alec made a wide, sweeping gesture.
And why not? Cramping your style, am I? I mean, maybe you were hoping to flirt with the werewolf boy here. He's pretty attractive, if you like the messy-haired, broad-shouldered, chiseled good looks type.
Hey now, said Jordan mildly.
Magnus put his head in his hands.
Or there are plenty of pretty girls here, since apparently your taste goes both ways. Is there anything you aren't into? Mermaids, said Magnus into his fingers. They always smell like seaweed.
It's not funny, Alex said savagely, and kicking back his chair, he got up from the table and stalked off into the crowd.
Magnus still had his head in his hands, the black spikes of his hair sticking out between his fingers.
I just don't see, he said to no one in particular, why the past has to matter.
To Simon's surprise, it was Jordan who answered.
The past always matters, he said. That's what they tell you when you join the Praetor. You can't forget things you did in the past, and you'll never learn from them.
Magnus looked up, his gold-green eyes glinting through his fingers.
How old are you? He demanded. 16?
18, said Jordan, looking slightly frightened.
Alex age, thought Simon, suppressing an interior grin. He didn't really find Alec and Magnus's drama funny, but it was hard not to feel a certain bitter amusement at Jordan's expression.
Jordan had to be twice Magnus's size. Despite being tall, Magnus was slender to the point of skinniness, but Jordan was clearly afraid of him. Simon turned to share a glance with Clary, but she was staring off toward the front door, her face gone suddenly bone white. Dropping a napkin onto the table, she murmured, "Excuse me," and got to her feet, practically fleeing the table. Magnus threw his hands up.
"Well, if there's going to be a mass exodus," he said,
and got up gracefully, flinging his scarf around his neck. He vanished into the crowd, presumably looking for Alec. Simon looked at Jordan, who was looking at Maya again. She had her back to them and was talking to Luke and Jocelyn, laughing, flinging her curly hair back.
"Don't even think about it," Simon said, and got up.
He pointed at Jordan.
"You stay here."
"And do what?" Jordan demanded.
"Whatever Praetor Lupus do in this situation. Meditate, contemplate your Jedi powers, whatever. I'll be back in 5 minutes, and you better still be here."
Jordan leaned back, crossing his arms over his chest in a clearly mutinous manner, but Simon had already stopped paying attention. He turned and moved into the crowd, following Clary. She was a speck of red and gold among the moving bodies, crowned with her twist of bright hair. He caught up to her by one of the light-wrapped pillars and put a hand on her shoulder. She turned with a startled exclamation, eyes wide, hands raised as if to fend him off. She relaxed when she saw who it was.
"You scared me."
"Obviously," Simon said.
"What's going on? What are you so freaked out about?"
She lowered her hand with a shrug.
Despite her forced look of casual dismissal, the pulse was going in her neck like a hammer.
"I thought I saw Jace."
"I figured," Simon said.
But, you look really frightened."
He wasn't sure why he said it exactly, or what it was he was hoping she'd say back. She bit her lip, the way she always did when she was nervous. Her gaze for a moment was far away. It was a look familiar to Simon. One of the things he'd always loved about Clary was how easily caught up in her imagination she was. How easily she could wall herself away in illusory worlds of curses and princes, and destiny and magic. Once he had been able to do the same, had been able to inhabit imaginary worlds, all the more exciting for being safe, for being fictional. Now that the real and the imagined had collided, he wondered if she, like he, longed for the past, for the normal. He wondered if normalcy was something, like vision or silence you didn't realize was precious until you lost it.
"He's having a hard time," she said in a low voice. "I'm scared for him."
"I know," Simon said.
"Look, not to pry, but has he figured out what's wrong with him? Has anyone?"
She broke off.
"He's all right. He's just having a hard time coming to terms with some of the Valentine stuff, you know?"
Simon did know. He also knew she was lying. Clary, who hardly hid anything from him. He gave her a hard look.
"He's been having bad dreams," she said. "He was worried that there was some demon involvement."
"Demon involvement?"
Simon echoed in disbelief. He'd known that Jace was having bad dreams. He'd said as much, but Jace had never mentioned demons.
"Well, apparently there are kinds of demons that try to reach you through your dreams," Clary said,
sounding as if she was sorry she'd brought it up at all.
"But I'm sure it's nothing. Everyone has bad dreams sometimes, don't they?"
She put a hand on Simon's arm.
"I'm just going to see how he is. I'll come back."
Her gaze was already sliding past him, toward the doors that led onto the terrace. He stood back with a nod and let her go, watching her as she moved off into the crowd. She looked so small,
small the way she had in first grade, when he'd walked her to the front door of her house and watched her go up the stairs, tiny and determined, her lunchbox banging against her knee as she went. He felt his heart, which no longer beat, contract, and he wondered if there was anything in the world as painful as not being able to protect the people you loved.
"You look sick," said a voice at his elbow,
husky and familiar.
"Thinking about what a horrible person you are?"
Simon turned and saw Maya leaning against the pillar behind him. She had a strand of the small glowing white lights wound around her neck, and her face was flushed with champagne and the warmth of the room.
"Or maybe I should say," she went on, "what a horrible vampire you are. Except that makes it sound like you're bad at being a vampire."
"I am bad at being a vampire," Simon said, "but that doesn't mean I wasn't bad at being a boyfriend, too." She smiled crookedly.
"Bat says I shouldn't be so hard on you," she said. "He says guys do stupid things when girls are involved, especially geeky ones who previously haven't had much luck with women."
"It's like he can see into my soul."
Maya shook her head.
"It's hard to stay mad at you," she said, "but I'm working on it."
She turned away.
"Maya,"
Simon said. His head had started to ache, and he felt a little dizzy. If he didn't talk to her now, though, he never would.
"Please, wait."
She turned back and looked at him, both eyebrows raised questioningly.
"I'm sorry about what I did," he said. "I know I said that before, but I really do mean it."
She shrugged, expressionless, giving him nothing. He swallowed past the pain in his head.
"Maybe Bat's right," he said. "But I think there's more to it than that. I wanted to be with you because, and this is going to sound so selfish, you made me feel normal. Like the person I was before."
"I'm a werewolf, Simon. Not exactly normal."
"But you are,"
he said, stumbling over his words a little.
"You're genuine and real. One of the realest people I've ever known. You wanted to come over and play Halo. You wanted to talk about comics and check out concerts and go dancing and just do normal things. And you treated me like I was normal. You never called me Daylighter, or Vampire, or anything but Simon."
"That's all friend stuff," Maya said. She was leaning against the pillar again, her eyes glinting softly as she spoke.
"Not girlfriend stuff."
Simon just looked at her, his headache pulsed like a heartbeat.
"And then you come around," she added, "bringing Jordan with you." "What were you thinking?" "That's not fair," Simon protested. "I had no idea he was your ex."
"I know. Isabel told me," Maya interrupted. "I just feel like giving you hell about it anyway."
"Oh, yeah?"
Simon glanced over at Jordan, who was sitting alone at the round linen-draped table, like a guy whose prom date hadn't shown up. Simon suddenly felt very tired. Tired of worrying about everyone. Tired of feeling guilty for the things he'd done and would probably do in the future.
"Well, did Izzy tell you that Jordan got himself assigned to me so he could be near you? You should hear the way he asks about you. The way he says your name, even. Man, the way he ripped into me when he thought I was cheating on you."
"You weren't cheating. We weren't exclusively dating. Cheating is different." Simon smiled as Maya broke off, blushing.
"I guess it's good that you dislike him so much that you'll take my side against him no matter what," he said.
"It's been years," she said. "He's never tried to get in touch with me, not once."
"He did try," Simon said. "Did you know the night he bit you was the first time he ever turned?"
She shook her head, her curls bouncing, her wide amber eyes very serious. "No, I thought he knew."
"That he was a werewolf? No. He knew he was losing control in some way, but who guesses they're turning into a werewolf? The day after he bit you, he went looking for you. But the Praetor stopped him. They kept him away from you. Even then, he didn't stop looking. I don't think a day's gone by in the past 2 years that he hasn't wondered where you were."
"Why are you defending him?" she whispered.
"Because you should know," said Simon. "I sucked at being a boyfriend, and I owe you. You should know he didn't mean to abandon you. He only took me on as an assignment because your name was mentioned in the notes on my case."
Her lips parted. As she shook her head, the glittering lights of her necklace winked like stars.
"I just don't know what I'm supposed to do with that, Simon. What am I supposed to do?" "I don't know," Simon said.
His head felt like nails were being pounded into it,
but I can tell you one thing. I'm the last guy in the world you should be asking for relationship advice from.
He pressed a hand to his forehead.
I'm going to go outside, get some air. Jordan's over at that table there, if you want to talk to him.
He gestured over toward the tables, and then turned away, away from my questioning eyes, from the eyes of everyone in the room. The sound of raised voices and laughter, and stumbled toward the doors.
Clary pushed open the doors that led out onto the terrace and was greeted by a rush of cold air. She shivered, wishing she had her coat but unwilling to take up any time going back to the table to get it. She stepped out onto the terrace and shut the door behind her. The terrace was a wide expanse of flagstones surrounded by ironwork railings. Tiki torches burned in big pewter holders, but they did little to warm the air, which probably explained why no one was out here but Jace. He was standing by the railing looking out over the river. She wanted to run over to him, but she couldn't help hesitating. He was wearing a dark suit, the jacket open over a white shirt, and his head was turned to the side, away from her. She had never seen him dressed like this before, and it made him look older and a little remote. The wind off the river lifted his fair hair, and she saw the little scar across the side of his throat where Simon had bitten him once. And she remembered that Jace had let himself be bitten, had risked his life for her. "Jace," she said. He turned and looked at her and smiled. The smile was familiar and seemed to unlock something inside her, freeing her to rush across the flagstones to him and throw her arms around him. He picked her up and held her off the ground for a long time, his face buried in her neck. "You're all right," she said finally, when he set her down. She scrubbed fiercely at the tears that had spilled out of her eyes. "I mean, the Silent Brothers wouldn't have let you go if you weren't all right. But I thought they said the ritual was going to take a long time, days even." "It didn't." He put his hands on either side of her face and smiled down at her. Behind him, the Queensboro Bridge arced out over the water. "You know the Silent Brothers. They like to make a big deal out of everything they do. But it's actually a pretty simple ceremony," he grinned. "I felt kind of stupid. It's a ceremony meant for little kids. But I just kept thinking that if I got it over with fast, I'd get to see you in your sexy party dress. It got me through." His eyes raked her up and down, and let me tell you, I am not disappointed. "You're gorgeous." "You look pretty good yourself." She laughed a little through the tears. "I didn't even think you owned a suit." "I didn't. I had to buy one." He slid his thumbs over her cheekbones where the tears had made them damp. "Clary, why did you come out here?" she asked. "It's freezing. Don't you want to go back inside?" He shook his head. "I wanted to talk to you alone." "So talk," Clary said in a half whisper. She took his hands away from her face and put them on her waist. Her need to be held against him was almost overwhelming. "Is something else wrong? Are you going to be okay? Please don't hold anything back from me. After everything that's happened, you should know I can handle any bad news." She knew she was nervously chattering, but she couldn't help it. Her heart felt as if it were beating 1,000 miles a minute. "I just want you to be all right," she said as calmly as she could. His gold eyes darkened. "I keep going through that box, the one that belonged to my father. I don't feel anything about it, the letters, the photos. I don't know who those people were. They don't feel real to me." Valentine was real. Clary blinked. It wasn't what she'd expected him to say. "Remember, I said that it would take time." He didn't even seem to hear her. "If I really were Jace Morgenstern, would you still love me? If I were Sebastian, would you love me?" She squeezed his hands. "You could never be like that." "If Valentine did to me what he did to Sebastian, would you love me?" There was an urgency to the question that she didn't understand, Clary said. But then, you wouldn't be you. His breath caught, almost as if what she'd said had hurt him. But how could it have? It was the truth. He wasn't like Sebastian. He was like himself. I don't know who I am, he said. I look at myself in the mirror and I see Stephen Herondale. But I act like a Lightwood and talk like my father, like Valentine. So I see who I am in your eyes, and I try to be that person, because you have faith in that person, and I think faith might be enough to make me what you want. You're already what I want. You always have been, Clary said. But she couldn't help feeling as if she were calling into an empty room. It was as if Jace couldn't hear her, no matter how many times she told him she loved him. I know you feel like you don't know who you are, but I do. I know. And someday you will too. And in the meantime, you can't keep worrying about losing me, because it'll never happen. There is a way. Jace raised his eyes to hers. Give me your hand. Surprised, Clary reached her hand out, remembering the first time he'd ever taken her hand like that. She had the rune now, the open eye rune, on the back of her hand, the one he'd been looking for then and hadn't found. Her first permanent rune. He turned her hand over, baring her wrist, the vulnerable skin of her forearm. She shivered. The wind off the river felt as if it were driving into her bones. Jace, what are you doing? Remember what I said about Shadowhunter weddings? How instead of exchanging rings, we mark each other with runes of love and commitment. He looked at her, his eyes wide and vulnerable under their thick gold lashes. I want to mark you in a way that will bind us together, Clary. It's just a small mark, but it's permanent. Are you willing? She hesitated. A permanent rune. When they were so young, her mother would be incensed. But nothing else seemed to be working. Nothing she said convinced him. Maybe this would. Silently, she drew out her steely and handed it to him. He took it, brushing her fingers as he did. She was shivering harder now, cold everywhere except where he touched her. He cradled her arm against him and lowered the steely, touching it softly to her skin, moving it gently up and down, and then, when she didn't protest, with more force. As cold as she was, the burn of the steely was almost welcome. She watched as the dark line spiraled out from the tip of it, forming a pattern of hard, angular lines. Her nerves tingled with a sudden alarm. The pattern didn't speak of love and commitment to her. There was something else there, something darker, something that spoke of control and submission, of loss and darkness. Was he drawing the wrong rune? But this was Jace. Surely he knew better than that. And yet a numbness was beginning to spread up her arm from the place the steely touched, a painful tingling, like nerves waking up, and she felt dizzy, as if the ground were moving under her. Jace? Her voice rose, tinged with anxiety. Jace? I don't think that's right. He let her arm go. He held the steely balanced lightly in his hand with the same grace with which he would hold any weapon. I'm sorry, Clary, he said. I do want to be bound to you. I would never lie about that. She opened her mouth to ask him what on earth he was talking about, but no words came. The darkness was rushing up too fast. The last thing she felt was Jace's arms around her as she fell. After what seemed like an eternity of wandering around what he considered to be an extremely boring party, Magnus finally found Alec, sitting alone at a table in a corner behind a spray of artificial white roses. There were a number of champagne glasses on the table, most half full, as if passing partygoers had abandoned them there. Alec was looking rather abandoned himself. He had his chin in his hands and was staring moodily into space. He didn't look up, even when Magnus hitched a foot around the chair opposite him, spun it toward him, and sat down, resting his arms along the back.
"Do you want to go back to Vienna?" he said.
Alec didn't answer, just stared into space.
"Or we could go somewhere else," said Magnus. "Anywhere you want.
Thailand? South Carolina? Brazil? Peru?"
"Oh, wait.
No, I'm banned from Peru."
"I'd forgotten about that. It's a long story, but amusing if you want to hear it."
Alec's expression said that he very much did not want to hear it. Pointedly, he turned and looked out over the room as if the werewolf string quartet fascinated him. Since Alec was ignoring him, Magnus decided to amuse himself by changing the colors of the champagne in the glasses on the table. He made one blue, the next pink, and was working on green when Alec reached across the table and hit him on the wrist.
"Stop that," he said. "People are looking."
Magnus looked down at his fingers, which were spraying blue sparks. Maybe it was a bit obvious. He curled his fingers under.
"Well," he said, "I have to do something to keep myself from dying of boredom, since you're not talking to me."
"I'm not," said Alec. "Not talking to you, I mean."
"Oh," said Magnus. "I just asked you if you wanted to go to Vienna or Thailand or the moon, and I don't recall you saying anything in response."
"I don't know what I want." Alec, his head bent, was playing with an abandoned plastic fork. Though his eyes were defiantly cast down, their pale blue color was visible even through his lowered eyelids, which were pale and as fine as parchment. Magnus had always found humans more beautiful than any other creatures alive on the earth, and had often wondered why. Only a few years before dissolution, Camille had said. But it was mortality that made them what they were. The flame that blazed brighter for its flickering. Death is the mother of beauty, as the poet said. He wondered if the angel had ever considered making his human servants, the Nephilim, immortal. But no, for all their strength, they fell as humans had always fallen in battle through all the ages of the world. "You've got that look again," Alec said peevishly, glancing up through his lashes. "Like you're staring at something I can't see. Are you thinking about Camille?"
"Not really," Magnus said.
"How much of the conversation I had with her did you overhear?"
"Most of it."
Alec prodded the tablecloth with his fork. "I was listening at the door."
"Enough."
"Not at all enough, I think." Magnus glared at the fork, and it skidded out of Alec's grasp and across the table toward him. He slammed his hand down on top of it and said, "Stop fidgeting."
"What was it I said to Camille that bothered you so much?"
Alec raised his blue eyes. "Whose will?" Magnus exhaled a sort of laugh. "Will, dear God. That was a long time ago. Will was a shadow hunter, like you. And yes, he did look like you. But you're not anything like him. Jace is much more the way Will was, in personality at least. And my relationship with you is nothing like the one I had with Will. Is that what's bothering you?"
"I don't like thinking you're only with me because I look like some dead guy you liked."
"I never said that. Camille implied it. She is a master of implication and manipulation. She always has been."
"You didn't tell her she was wrong."
"If you let Camille, she will attack you on every front. Defend one front, and she will attack another. The only way to deal with her is to pretend she isn't getting to you."
"She said pretty boys were your undoing," Alec said.
"Which makes it sound like I'm just one in a long line of toys for you. One dies or goes away, you get another one. I'm nothing. I'm trivial."
"Alexander."
"Which," Alec went on, staring down at the table again, is especially unfair because you are anything but trivial for me. I changed my whole life for you. But nothing ever changes for you, does it? I guess that's what it means to live forever.